Before she got famous, in the early days of the internet, you met Jennifer Aniston, ended up dating for almost 2 years. Fact or fiction?
That is,
Though it masquerades as an ad agency, Mischief is actually a money laundering operation owned by the Russian drug cartel.
Are you ready to meet Greg Hahn, the founder of Mischief at No Fixed Address, the most talked about agency in the world? If you are ready to get up close and personal with Ad Age's CCO of the Year, then we regret to inform you that you will not actually be meeting Greg in person on this podcast. If your plan was to smell his hair musk or caress his cheekbones with your hands, then you must not know what a podcast is and also what's wrong with you. Hear Greg talk about the creative witchcraft required to grow one of the world's most sought-after creative agencies out of thin air in just 4 short years, and the creative juggernaut behind campaigns like Tubi's Interface Interruption.
Greg, the game going like you expected?
Yeah, and so far, these teams, they've really...
Who is this? Get up,
everybody!
Tinder's Meet Cutes.
She says hi. Smirk emoji.
Meet Cutes happen every day on Tinder.
And Pizza Hut's resumes.
Yeah, I just think it's always comes back to be true to yourself. Don't make bad choices based off of fear.
You will hear stories, advice, anecdotes, and a fun fact or fiction interview game between Greg Hahn and podcast host Jason Bagley.
That is a true fact. Yes, that is also true. No, none of that is true.
Just two advertising executives showing the world that they like to keep it light and have a real fun time. But if you want to be within arm's reach of Greg and feel his electricity pulsate through a room in a very present and physical way, then again, this podcast is not for you. This is simply a listening and looking experience. If you're hoping to run up and give Greg a hug without asking, please be aware that this is just a podcast. And even if it wasn't, good luck getting past Greg's security detail.
What advice would you give to young people starting their careers that they may not want to hear?
So please join us this week to learn all about Greg Hahn on the Bagley Talks to an Important Person podcast. And by join, we mean stay the hell away from Greg Hahn. This is just an informative podcast about Greg, not an invitation to inhabit his life, which we have heard is very exclusive and hard to get into.
It's Jason Bagley's advertising podcast. He interviews important people, it's true. But that doesn't mean that you're not important, cause he didn't choose to interview you. Maybe he was just planning to contact you to interview you on another day. Or maybe he doesn't have your email address. Every creature on the planet is important in their own special way. Cows, sharks, and gazelles deserve to be interviewed. Birds and whales each have a valid point of view. I mean, they're probably not as interesting to talk to as you, but you're less interesting than the person on this show. It's true, I'm not sure what my point is.
Let's start with a little game of fact or fiction. So, you used to work down the hall from the author of everyone's favorite ad book, Hey Whipple Squeeze This, and ad legend, Luke Sullivan. Fact or fiction?
That is a true fact. That is one of the benefits of working at Fallon during those times is it was pretty much a hall of legends. Very intimidating for a junior to walk around and see all these names. But Luke would sit in his office and bang out some brilliance. He was actually writing that book when I got there, and he had like a bunch of interns proofreading it for him.
That's crazy. Yeah, I remember before that book came out, I knew who Luke Sullivan was. He was a copywriting legend.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, before she got famous, in the early days of the internet, you met Jennifer Aniston in a chat room and ended up dating for almost 2 years, and you have a small Jen tattoo in the small of your back.
Parts of that are true. No, none of that is true. I will say, though, when I lived in LA, I went to this guy to cut my hair, and his name is Chris something or other. And I went to him all the time, and then he did Jennifer Aniston's friend's cut. And I never fucking saw him again because I could never get into him. And he became like the guy in Hollywood doing everybody's hair. But so that's my only Jennifer Aniston connection.
You were like, come on, man, get me in for that Aniston haircut.
I wanted the friend's cut bad. He's like, no, that's Jen's thing. That's between us. So,
yeah. So I was actually one of the first campaigns that I produced at Wyden. We were in LA making it, and we were shooting with Jared Hess, the director of Napoleon Dynamite. It was his first ever commercial campaign that he ever did. And we were at Moxie Pictures, and we're walking out. We're leaving. And as I'm walking out, this one of the office doors, like on the hallway, opens up, and this woman, you know, walks out. A dog comes out into the hallway, and this woman comes out to get the dog, picks up the dog, stands up, and it's Jennifer Aniston. And she turns toward me, and she's like, oh, hi, and put her hand out. I'm Jen. And introduced, like, I didn't say hi. She said hi. She put her hand out. She introduced herself. And so she was super nice.
Yeah, from all accounts, I've heard she is actually really nice in person. But that's a lot about Jennifer Aniston.
That's the most of this podcast is going to be focused on Jennifer Aniston.
I like that angle.
Okay, a t-shirt I wrote for California Pizza Kitchen. Sorry, a t-shirt that you wrote for California Pizza Kitchen played a small part in the OJ trial.
That is true. I'm reminded of this actually because OJ just passed away, you know, God rest his soul, I guess. But anyway, when I was a junior, you know, part of the fun of being a junior is to get the random assignments of like, write the t-shirt for California Pizza Kitchen. And I wrote it and it had some sort of weird message on it. I guess this was a time when the jurors were fighting or whatever. And then the next Monday they came into court all wearing this t-shirt that had this message on it. And I remember lighting up the news all day and that, like being on Geraldo at night on Fox News. And there's just this great image of OJ and his lawyers all just staring at the jury as they walk in going, what the fuck does this mean? There's so much reading into it. And they're like breaking down every word of the message. And I was just like, it was just an assignment. Sorry.
What did it say?
It's funny because someone sent it to me. It said something like 14 ethnically diverse cultures peacefully living on the thin, delicious crust. So they took that to mean like, can't we all get along? It was really about the flavors of pizza that they offer. And they're like the crust of the earth. And like, it's this message for like everybody getting along and all that kind of stuff, which it kind of was a play on that. But they read a lot into it. And dare I say, affected the jury? Hopefully not. But
that's crazy. It is funny. Yeah. Funny to see when your stuff kind of becomes a part of culture in some weird way.
Yeah, I know. I remember sitting in my shitty little apartment in LA, watching all this like Fox News talk dissect this thing and holding it up and trying to think. And it's like, if you only knew how little thought went into this t-shirt, you wouldn't be talking.
Okay, you once had a surreal moment on set where you had a conversation with James Brown and Marilyn Manson.
Yes, that is also true. Because we were shooting BMW films at that time, and that was one of those projects where every day was surreal because you're just the people you're dealing with and the kind of situations they threw you in. But anyway, we were shooting this one with Tony Scott was the director, and James Brown was a star, and there's a cameo with Marilyn Manson, so they were on set the same day. And they're just over there talking, and I was standing around them, kind of happy to be in their circle for some reason. And the conversation was amazing. I remember Marilyn asked James Brown to sign his Bible, and James Brown goes, do you believe in Jesus? And Marilyn had the best answer. He said, I believe in him. I just don't think he believes in me. I was like, whoa, shit. Like, this is a moment.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did James say to that?
God bless. Signed it. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Though it masquerades as an ad agency, Mischief is actually a money laundering operation owned by the Russian drug cartel.
I will not confirm or deny that as fact or fiction. That is absolutely fiction. We are an ad agency and whatever you call it, ad agencies these days.
We're going to, so, I'm going to,
for the record, we are not a laundering service.
I'm going to edit that out and just have you say that is absolutely false because that sounded very guilty.
To tell like I had too much to object to.
You were like, little,
don't ever say that again. Don't ever bring that up again.
Thou protest too much.
I believe so.
The first ad you ever produced, you wrote with the owner of the agency in the job interview for the first, your very first job in advertising.
Correct. This was when I was in LA. Very strange interview because it was like 8 o'clock at night in this massive, like, glitzy tower in LA overlooking all of LA. And, you know, he's like the only one there. So I, you know, knock on the big wooden doors. His assistant was waiting out there. She led me in. Doors swing open. And there he was, this chief creative officer, co-owner of the agency, sitting at this long table. It's like a scene from a movie, dark LA sky behind him. I'm just kind of sitting there at the end of this long table waiting for him to acknowledge my presence. And finally, after a while, he's like, working on something. I'm like, are you working on something? He's like, yeah, I got to do an outdoor board. It's I've showed a client tomorrow. So, and I was like, what's it for? And we just started riffing. And then I wrote the board for him and he sold it. And then he still didn't give me the job. I had to come back for another interview. I'm like, come on, man.
That's like the ultimate test, and you passed it and he still didn't give it to you.
This was a hard place to work. Yeah, it was, I had good experiences, but it was notoriously hard in LA. And in fact, my the only other writer in the place and joined later was Harold Einstein. So that's me and Harold became really close during those years.
Wow, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Was Harold hilarious?
Yes. Harold was genius all the way back. I learned so much from him just watching him. If you think he's good on a conference call now, just imagine him like pitching his own work to clients. He's really good.
That's awesome. I have actually, it's one of my regrets so far is I've actually never shot with Harold Einstein, despite being a huge part of so much of his work.
Yeah. Yeah. I've shot with him a couple times, but he's very smart. Yeah. Extremely well-spoken. Yeah. He's great.
Okay, you once told the CEO of GE, General Electric, that you were on acid, and you told the co-founder of Fallon, Pat Fallon, that you drink before work. Fact or fiction?
This comes under the heading of things not to say to the people at top. But I jokingly on both of them, I don't do either of those things. But the one time when I got the opportunity to meet the head guy of GE at the time, one of the most important people in the world of business, and they were taking him through a tour of the agency. I was sitting in the ECD office, the office of the ECD of GE, and they brought him in to meet me and him. And they said, oh, this is Greg. He wrote that ideas spot that you like, which is like this kind of ideas creature weird thing. He's like, oh, were you on some kind of acid flashback when you wrote that? I said, no, it wasn't a flashback. He just looked at me like, oh, what the fuck? I got an answer. I was like, and then he laughed. I think he got that. I didn't mean I was actually doing acid during the thing. And then the Pat Fallon was kind of another stupid thing because I was a really dumb junior. And I never met Pat Fallon. I just kind of knew the name. I didn't even know if he was still in the building or not. And Pat was great, super personable guy. But he went around the building and then I was working on some Miller Lite stuff that he liked. And he knew that I'd written it. So as he passed me in the hall, he's like, hey, Greg, do you drink beer? And first thing I thought of was like, just before work in the mornings. And he looked at me. and he looked at me. And then he laughed. And he's like, okay. And kept walking.
Just before, like, only before work. Not yeah. all just before work.
Just yeah, that's the only time I drink. Then he just kept walking and kind of had the idea that he probably thought I was either really dumb or had a problem from there on. A little bit of both.
There was more of that going on back in the early days.
Yeah, there probably was. I think I kind of missed that era. I came right under the radar of that era. But we had Miller Lite, so there was a lot of it floating around. So he was probably like, wait, does he? No, I didn't.
Most of those seem like they would be fictional, but they are, in fact, factual, which is, I think, one of the fun things about this industry is, as your stories just show, like, I don't know what else I could have done personally that I would have had so many weird and unusual and cool experiences.
Yeah, it opens you up to, it exposes you to a lot of interesting people and puts you in a lot of unusual spaces. So there's many more factual based stories in my closet, but yeah, you found some good ones.
So speaking of Fallon, you mentioned Fallon. I remember when I started out, I don't know, I you know, the industry changes and people who work in the industry and everything changes. So I don't know what people's impression, like especially younger people starting out, how they look at different agencies and stuff. But when I started out, there were four main agencies that were legendary and that were consistently doing great work. At least four that I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm missing one. But these were the agencies that were constantly doing great work. It was Wyden, Goodby, yep, Cliff Freeman, and Fallon.
And what, yeah, exactly. We're the same era.
And I guess Shiat was... Shiat was probably was in that mix still as well. And at that time, you knew the top creatives that were in each of those shops. Mm-hmm. Like there was a handful, I mean, anybody that worked, any creative as an outsider, they were all rock stars to me if they had a job at any of those agencies.
Yeah.
It seemed like an impossibility to ever work at one of those places when I first started out. But there was usually like a handful of people that were, you just saw them in all the award show annuals. They were constantly up and they were just like rock stars and you knew all their names. I wanted to work at places like that because I wanted to make the kind of work they were making. But I also just wanted to hang out with those people. They seemed like these people must be so interesting and cool. So when you, at that time, because that we, I think you were a little slightly earlier than me, but not by much, you joined Fallon and it was during that time. And I imagine you felt the same way. Like Fallon was this legendary,
yeah,
with all these legendary creatives. What was that like for you when you first got there?
Intimidating. Well, back up a little bit is because I was in LA and I didn't go to ad school, but I did, like probably a lot of people in that era had to just go through tons of award show annuals and, you know, CA and one show and all those kind of things just to see what good work looked like. And I kept seeing Fallon. Every page on some of those was just Fallon, Fallon, Fallon. So I didn't know idea what they were, where they were. So I, you know, did a little research and obviously found out they're in Minneapolis, of all places, but they had so many good writers and art directors there, just the creative there, and their names were on every page. So I knew that by the time I started looking for a job and, you know, had my wish list, they were top. And I knew all the people who worked there, you know, it was like my sports. I knew all the players and I got a chance to interview up there. I'm like, I love LA. There's no way I'm going to move to Minneapolis, but Fallon called and you kind of have to take the call. And I went up there and the first thing you do when you walk out of the elevator is see all these legendary Porsche ads, just all the ads I saw in the books. They were just hanging on the walls. And I was like, oh shit, this is the real deal. And then you walk by and you see all the people sitting in their offices or the names on the offices of all the people you've been studying. And I was like, I cannot, if they ever offer me the job, I cannot say no. I have to move to Minneapolis as much as that's not, you know, my thing. I kind of have to do it. And they did offer me the job and I was like, shit, I'd be stupid at this age not to take that up. And it was amazing. You know, it's one of those places like you just learn by being in that atmosphere and, you know, hearing what other people throw out and how they get to their ideas and seeing what's on their walls and what's coming off the printer. It was just in the air there. It was great.
Well, you were one of those people for me. Like when I, like you were one of those names.
Oh, thank you.
Fallon crew that I just constantly saw and was like, oh my gosh, Greg Hahn, everything Greg Hahn does is amazing. And I think you were probably there. I mean, I'm sure you overlapped with the Swedes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, they started right after I did. Yeah. Lisa and Paul, the girl.
Yeah, they were a big influence on me early on in terms of just like seeing that you could just be crazy and
yeah. do
like really out there comedy stuff. It sort of like shattered some limitations that maybe I had of what was possible.
Yeah. They did stir everything up in what they thought was the Minneapolis School of Advertising. Those guys just came in from left field and it was just like, what the fuck? It was so, so genius and so unexpected and, you know, hard to do, seemingly easy, very hard to do. Well, at least.
My guess is they weren't necessarily trying to do that. They were just doing what they wanted to do. They were doing what like came naturally to them and what they thought was good. And they didn't have the baggage. This is why I think so much innovation comes from immigrants, because immigrants come in to like a new land and they're unfamiliar with like what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do, what all the rules are. And they're just like, they just see something with fresh eyes and they just like, well, let's just do this. And I wonder if that's what the Swedes did. They just came here, they're Swedish, and they just were like, well, why don't we do what we want to do? And they didn't realize how crazy it was compared to everything else.
No, they had no idea. I just thought that it was just natural to them. And everything they saw America as sort of this weird, campy, surrealistic place. And what they were doing is normal. Linus, you know, Paul both grew up watching American reruns of 70s shows, you know, so their idea of America was like what they put out. A lot of their stuff was kind of campy in that way. But I remember them, you know, they did the crazy thing about that is they did that kind of work for one of the biggest brands in the country at that time, for Miller Lite. And they were all over TV, and that was not mainstream shit. That was very avant-garde. Yeah. And I remember Linus was telling me y'all should try to Google the stuff they did like for early Miller Lite. But he said he was in a bar, a country bar, and one of their spots came on TV and everyone looked at it and then just shook their head and went back to drinking. no idea what they were watching. Yeah.
And for me, it was, and I think probably for you too, but it was as cool as I thought it would be. Like when I got quiet and I was like, I imagined, wow, what would it be like to hang around the people that are doing this work?
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
It was.
They were not that they were, and this is something I tell people who haven't had an opportunity yet to work at a great agency. They're not necessarily cooler or smarter than you. They're super curious. They're usually pretty down to earth people, I find. Yeah. They're pretty nice, cool people that just, they work really hard. They have kind of a sense of their own voice and what they like, but they're not like Einstein. They're not as different from you as you think. They're just,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's 100% true at Fallon for sure. It was some of the most down to earth, just cool, nice, you know, humble people that you will meet. And you know, what I brought to it was this intimidation that they're not going to be that, but they wonder if, like, I was afraid to go to Wyden because I didn't think I would fit in there. I thought they were way too cool for me.
I 100% thought the same thing. And I thought when I did get the job, I thought they're going to discover in about 60 days that I don't belong here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because yeah, I thought I made the assumption by their work that they were just super cool. And I did not see myself as being cool. And yeah, there was maybe a few people there that I would describe as super cool, but for the most part, not really. They were just, they loved what they did. They were super interested in what they were doing. They were like, they were into stuff that was interesting and cool, but they weren't themselves like super hipster or, you know, the pretty down to earth people.
Yeah. You find that. I mean, a lot of this industry is built around people that are pretty outside, You know, there a lot of them never were cool in school, and they're just people that have a different slant on things, and that makes them interesting. Maybe not makes them, you know, the homecoming king, but it does make them someone you want to hang out with.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, everybody, if you're interested in making better work and would like to know exactly how my teams and I at Wieden & Kennedy and now at Alto have been making award-winning work for the past 20 years on brands like Nike, Old Spice, KFC, and others, I have what has been called the industry's premier creative coaching and mentorship program. I didn't call it that, but other people did, and then I just said it into this microphone just now. I've taken almost 700 creatives through my program so far, and they have an average 5-star rating. Is that 5 out of 10? If that's 5 out of 10, that's a really bad rating. Oh, it's 5 out of 5. It's 5 out of 5, everybody. That's an A+. These programs are not for everyone, but if you qualify, I will personally teach you exactly, step-by-step, how to rapidly start doing the best work of your life. I have sessions starting in 1 week, and nearly every session so far has sold out. So if you are interested in grabbing one of the final remaining spots, you can apply at the link below. I hope to see you there.
Let's talk about this little agency called Mischief for a second. To me, it's irrefutable that over the past 4 years that there's no other agency that has been on as much of a tear than Mischief, and just constantly talked about, constantly doing great work. And I think what makes the story for me so cool and interesting and kind of relatable is that, like all great stories, it kind of starts with disappointment and probably heartache and maybe some defeat. And, you know, from the ashes came this amazing story. So talk about, like, you know, you were very publicly laid off from BBDO after like a 9-year incredible run as the CCO, or as, I don't, you weren't the CCO the whole time, but like, very, you know, a legendary CCO that was involved in a lot of wonderful work there at BBDO, and then had this probably, I would imagine, very shocking and public layoff. What was that when you were at your lowest point? Could you have ever imagined what has transpired?
Not at all. No, you're right. It was kind of like the classic Joseph Campbell story arc, but yeah, I mean, it was very shocking to me. But you know, if you remember back at the time, it's kind of hard to, you know, it's not been that long, but it's kind of hard to put yourself back in that place of like nobody knew what the fuck was going on. Like, were we ever going to come out of the pandemic? Was life ever going to get back to normal? You know, we're still on lockdown. Like, you couldn't go out anywhere. And so, you know, out of the blue, one day I get a call from David, who said, you know, said with they're making cuts and you are one of them, and, you know, process that. But, you know, I think what happened in a lot of the reasons I think we got attention right away is that I think a lot of people saw themselves in me, because what I kept hearing is like, if it could happen to you, nobody's safe, for all this kind of thing. I don't know if that's true, but I do remember people feeling that. And I think that's, you know, when it was so public and it was so kind of like at the peak of no one knows what the fuck is going on, that I think that helped in a way build the story.
Yeah.
And people were kind of watching to see what I was going to do. I kind of felt that pressure of like, I got to do something quick. Can't sit around. Yeah. So I was just talking to my partner, Dave LaFond, who I founded, one of the partners of Mischief. I was just talking to him today because he's like, he found, you know, we found this text that was April 28th on 2000, you know, almost exactly 4 years ago. And it was the first time I reached out to him going, hey, what are you guys doing over there? It looks kind of interesting. And this was, you know, a week, two weeks after I got let go. So we basically built the agency and launched in less than 5 weeks from being complete strangers.
Oh my gosh.
So I was not sitting around. My lowest point was like for the day I got laid off going, but you know, the one thing I kept feeling is like the world is upside down. I'm not the only one. Like, it's not just me who's spinning right now. So nobody, I can't freak out too much because look, nobody knows what's going on. And I kind of also saw it as an opportunity of, okay, if no one knows what's going on, no one also knows what's going to be next. Why don't we try to build that?
Do you think that you were kind of born with, like, that there's a lot of sort of naive optimism in what you just said. And is that, I know you're a humble guy, but do you think that's one of your superpowers, is naive optimism?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. I think you're right. Is I tend to just go like, what's the bright side of this? Like, how can we, with every setback, there's a opportunity. I always try to find that opportunity. I go, okay, you know, this could be something different. It might not be better, might not be worse, but let's see what's out there. There's a great Danish, I think it's Danish, saying that said, you know, don't complain about the wind, learn to sail. Which I think is like a really good way to look at life.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people could see themselves in your story. And I imagine everybody felt the way I did, which was for a lot of different reasons, but mainly because of the situation and because of kind of the story. And I think everyone was a fan of you and your work, that we were all kind of rooting for Mischief. It was like maybe people saw themselves in Mischief. And in you, and it was like everyone wanted it to succeed, I think. At least that's how I felt. I can't imagine anybody didn't want it to succeed because of this, the whole circumstances. Like we needed like a bright light of hope in the industry at that time.
It's funny you say that, and it makes me happy to hear you say that, because I really did feel that. I really felt like so many people were supportive of us, and you know, this can be a pretty competitive industry, but it was remarkable how many people, you know, reached out to say, you know, just love what you're doing, or thank you, or can we help you, or I know somebody who knows somebody. It was just like such a great atmosphere. It still is, and I think that we kind of need more of that, even though everybody's kind of settling out after the pandemic. It's getting quite competitive out there with agencies. I do think us just being in it for with each other is a good thing for the industry.
Yeah. I'm excited for anybody to make good work. I don't care if
you're a giant, it helps us all. It really does.
If you're a giant holding company or if you're a tiny upstart, like, it's good for everybody if good work gets made.
Yeah, I agree with that. It makes all our jobs kind of easier because clients also, you know, see the success of that. And you know, it's funny though, on the flip side of it, there are a lot of people that thought we were kind of like the big fuck you to holding companies. And although we certainly didn't do anything to propose that, but I do think that at the time holding companies were treating people so badly at that time and so coldly that it was kind of felt they brought that to the picture. Yeah. Like someone needs this to stand up to these guys.
So one of your ECDs, Bianca, who worked for you at BBDO, has said that she has seen a change in you, in your leadership and kind of your personality, a slight change from being CCO at BBDO to being the founder and CCO at Mischief. Just maybe a more playful, a more lighthearted and just easygoing version of yourself. Why do you think that is?
I mean, that's fair to say. I think because at BBDO and Omnicom as a, you know, an entity, there's just so much at stake, you know, and it just felt like there's this ambient pressure or fear of fucking up. And when I got to Mischief, I was like, I don't want any of that. I want it to be like, let's fuck things up. Or if you do, who cares? We'll move on. You know, it's just reason I was drawn to Dave LaFond again, you know, who we started with, is his philosophy was, what would you do if you're not afraid? And I kind of like that way of approaching everything. What would you do if you weren't afraid? And that's been our, you know, our working motive at Mischief, is to go for, be on the offense, not defense.
And why? Because I could see it being the opposite. Like, this is your thing, you know, you and your partners, but it's your thing. So in some ways you could be more stressed about it and more uptight about like, oh, this has to succeed. But it seems like it was a little bit the opposite of that. And
maybe I think it's because I felt responsibility and to, well, now I feel it to the people that work for me, but I think you can do those charts that are like, you find your Enneagram, whatever your number, your, I don't know, those personality charts. Well, I did one and it found out my biggest fear was letting people down or not, you know, meeting someone's expectations. So maybe that like a BDO or Omni, you know, that network, I felt like I was constantly having to prove myself. Whereas this, it's like I have high expectations of myself, but I can be a little bit more liberal of like what I think is good and what I think is fun and right. Like I'm the one making that decision, not having to do it based on someone else's rules.
Yeah. Your fate is more in your own hands now.
100%. I think that's the biggest thing I learned is like, you want your hands on the wheel of your own fate. And what made me feel that is because I didn't see that coming. And even David didn't see it coming, but there was an emergency meeting between the higher ups at Omnicom some weekend, often some lair somewhere, where they decided who was going to stay and who was going to go. And they were just crossing numbers off of a balance sheet. And I was like, that is a very fragile place to live.
Yeah. I think some people who have not been a CCO, in some ways I say people who have had the great pleasure of never being a CCO maybe to some extent, I thought this before I became a CCO, you think it's sort of glorious and like glamorous and like, oh, I'm going to have this high title and this position. And that lasts about 24 hours.
Yeah.
You get some nice press releases in the industry publications and you get, you know, 100 text messages from all your friends across the industry. And then that's it.
That fades away. Yeah. That goes away really quickly. And then you're left with the responsibility.
Yeah. Then it's just crushing responsibility that I think it's hard to explain to people who've never experienced it, just how crushing that the responsibility of being a CCO is. And did you find that to be the case? Obviously you did an amazing job for a long time, but it's a lot on your shoulders, isn't it?
It is. To the people that work for you, I always felt most responsible, still do. Those are the people I work for, you know, the creatives and the rest of the agency. And then also, again, there's such a pressure for money. And at Mischief, we decided money's not going to be the driving force at all. You know, do what you love and the money will come. I think that's proven out to us. But it's hard. And I think the other realization I came to on April 16th when I got laid off was that, you know, it sounds trivial and stupid to say, but your life is made up of days. And if you're not enjoying your days, then what's the point? So whatever my next thing was, I wanted to have fun. I wanted to make sure I woke up and was like psyched about the day and not dreading it. And that's, you know, as long as I'm doing that, I'm successful. And I don't care what the title is. So when people, you know, it's very tempting as a mid-level or junior to chase the title because, again, you get that rush of adrenaline on the first day and you get some good press. But that, you know, if you chase the title and the money, you end up paying for that. You know, it's a very expensive way to live if you're not happy. So I think there's so much pressure on people to like, what's my next job? What's my next title? What's my, you know, how can I advance? I would say worry about what you're doing now and then whatever happens will come naturally. Don't chase titles. Don't chase salaries. Make sure what you're doing now is fulfilling.
Maybe other people are way more talented than me, but I always felt like it took everything I had just to become great at my current job. I never thought about becoming a CD at White & Kennedy. It never crossed my mind until the first time it ever crossed my mind was I was in a review with Mark Fitzloff, and he said, you know, I see you as one of the next CDs of White & Kennedy. And I was like, what?
Man, you're so good at it. I'm not just saying it's because you're ass, but I like watch your videos to learn. It's good.
I just didn't, I was literally, I was so focused on just trying to be a good creative and make great work.
Yeah.
I think that was a huge blessing for me. And I think if I had been focused on, and I give this advice to young people that are talking too much about becoming a CD, and I'm like, it's going to take everything you got just to become a great creative. So just focus mm-hmm. on that. Focus on making great work. And if you focus on that, the CD thing is going to happen automatically.
Yeah.
You're not going to need to worry about it. And you're going to be more prepared to do it because you will have like put in the work and you'll know what it means to be a good creative and you'll have more production experience and all those things. So I just think like put your head down and focus on becoming great at what you're doing and the rest of it, it's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, I wish everyone would listen to that advice. And that's kind of the way it happened for me too, is I never like sought out, I never had some master plan. The only reason I became a CD, at Fallon, we didn't really have that many layers. It was like CCO, creative directors, everybody else. So I never really sought to climb that ladder. But when I moved from Fallon to BBDO, I started to talking to some people in the creative department and they're like, you don't want to work for anybody here. like and I saw the kind of work that was happening. And this is a very different time. And it just wasn't, I didn't think that they would get me. It was just a different style, a different kind of way. And so when I said to David, I was like, I really want to work for you. I don't want to work for, you know, some of these other people. And he said, well, if I bring you here, you can be ECD. I had no group, I had nothing. And I just, you know, leaped from creative to ECD at BBDO. I put the years in. I had the experience. I knew, like you say, as a creative, what it took to do good creative. And I had the, you know, all the production, all that kind of stuff. But I just never planned on going, you know, one rung of time up that ladder. It just wasn't
well,
what I, you know,
envisioned. By that point, you were one of the most award-winning creatives in the world. So you had definitely, while you may not have had like a lot of experience in the seat in creative leadership, you at least had a lot of experience with production and with like making great work.
Yeah, and with clients as well, because you know the way Fallon worked is pretty. They didn't shield you too much. You were in there. So yeah. So I did have the experience, but I think that is a huge lesson for everybody to learn is make sure you're good at what you're doing now before you're too focused on what's next.
Yeah. So you have been, you know, BBDO wasn't necessarily great when you got there, but you know, over time, I think thanks to Lou Bars and you and a lot of other amazing people that got brought in, you know, it became a place that was always producing great stuff. And it's a big agency. So not necessarily, maybe not across the board, but there was always award-winning work coming out of BBDO. And then of course, before that you were at Fallon for so long. So you've been at great agencies and now you started Mischief. You've been at great agencies and around great work pretty much your whole career. So you've spent the majority of your career at really good agencies around really great work. In what ways would you say that as an agency, making great work is really simple? And in what ways would you say it's really hard?
I think there are great creatives in every agency. I think what's really hard is getting it out the building, you know, into the real world. I think it's, in some ways, what they pay you for is going back and starting over. So I think at some places it's just harder to make good work. And I think at Mischief, what we've done that's helped us a lot is people know why they're coming to Mischief. So we're not having to sell them on the idea of doing good work. I think what was hard at BBDO at some cases is clients didn't come here for that. Not all of them. So you have to find out who has the appetite, who it's right for. You can't force it. And, you know, do what you can in those places. But I will say, like, BBDO was great when I got there, before I got there. It was just a different kind of great. I mean, they were like the agency of the 80s and 90s. It's just like things that were changing. So they needed to change the style a little bit. But there's a different atmosphere in an agency that can produce good work and sell good work.
Yeah. I think it's... people often ask me like, what's the secret? Like, you know, you spent most of your career at Wieden and Kennedy. What's their secret? What's their secret process? What are they doing? And it's actually, it's way simpler than anyone thinks. Like, it's less about any secrets, and it's more about consistency and everyone being on the same page, which I think you've done a great job, Mischief, of like, if everyone in the building has the same mission and they're really clear about what that is and they're really clear about the core values and everybody lives by them, there's no secrets beyond that. It's just a lot of what's happening. Actually, I was surprised when I got to Wieden that it was initially, it felt like they're doing kind of the same thing at the agency that I was at before that wasn't making great work. Like, the meetings were not fundamentally different. The way we presented work wasn't dramatically different. It's not until I was there for a long time that I saw it's the consistency of mission and values and how they're constantly practiced and everyone kind of working towards the same thing. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, a lot of that is true, especially everybody knowing why they're there and pushing for it. I also think that at an agency like Wieden, and we try to do it Mischief, is like, you just don't settle. Like, if you know the client is going to buy something great and they expect something great, you're going to have to deliver on that. I think I've worked at other agencies earlier in my career, and I think at some places where it's just easier to go in with mediocre work, you have to push yourself. At Mischief, we're all kind of like self-driven to make sure that the work we do is stuff that we really, really want to put out in the world. So I think a couple of things. One is the resilience to go back and make sure that the next round's even better if stuff dies, but also this idea of quality, of keeping it up, maintaining it, not settling.
Yeah. In both yourself and like all the amazing creatives that you've gotten to work with, how much of a connection do you think there is between having fun and enjoying the process and being successful?
Oh God, I don't know if there's a direct correlation. A lot of people will say, you know, you got to have fun, but I've seen some miserable people who are fucking brilliant. You know, I've never really worked with that many of them, but you do see it and hear about it. For me, I think you got to take the pressure off and create a space where people feel it's okay to be wrong and to fuck around and to try stuff. Otherwise, you're gonna limit what you put out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I ever create anything good when I'm miserable and not enjoying.
Yeah. I don't know. More
pressure.
I think you could probably feel it. Like a lot of those people that are that way, their work has a bit of a cynicism to it.
Yeah.
You can kind of feel it, but we try and try not to be too cynical.
I want to ask you for one quick favor. Turns out making a podcast takes a lot of time and money. So if you're enjoying these episodes, the best way that you can support the podcast is by clicking that subscribe button and the notification bell so you don't miss future episodes. So please do us a favor and click those buttons right now. Okay, let's do the podcast. Bye.
This is a two-part question. What advice would you give to young people starting their careers that they may not want to hear? And what advice would you give them that they would be maybe happy to hear?
The first thing you're going to have to come to terms with is things you love will die more than will live. And that's just part of the business. Like I say, you get paid for the things that die in a way. And the advice I would give to you there is just be better one more time than they're being bad. So just keep coming back to them. Keep coming back with better stuff. If you talk to a lot of these legendary creatives and about their campaigns and the things you worship, at least when my experience with getting to Fallon, it was often round six of a campaign, you know, of an idea that they tried to sell. So there's no limited supply of great ideas. The more you do it, the more you'll have. So don't get too precious. Don't get too attached to something. You know, feel the passion, but know that it happens to everybody.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know. That's kind of like both rolled into one.
Yeah. I think that's probably why, going back to this thing about enjoying the process, to me, that's why you have to figure out a way to enjoy it, because you're going to do the process a million times more than you're going to do the production of the idea.
Yeah.
Like you're just going to constantly be in the process generating more and more ideas because most everything's going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, when you, most of your days is coming up with the ideas. That's the most fun part is when you're sitting with your partner, you come up with it and you're like, holy shit, this is going to be fun. Like, this is cool. Like, you know, you got something. So you move on, right? Just having that one thing you're really excited about so you can go play in other spaces. There's another great quote. Like, I have a list of all these quotes. It's kind of cheesy, but this one is super relevant to what you're saying. And it's the idea that the person who loves walking will go further than the person who loves the destination.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah, it is true. It's like, you got to love the process and not worry about so much if you're there or not, because it doesn't matter, because what you're doing now is pretty good.
I'm going to replace the cliche, the joys in the journey, with that way cooler thing you just shared with me. So Mischief is known. I've heard you guys refer to yourselves as a strategy shop masquerading as a creative shop. You're known for great strategy and great insights. How mm-hmm. It's so common to hear creatives say they don't get that in the brief, like that the briefs they're getting don't really have an inspiring insight or, you know, mm-hmm. something great. What can you tell us about how to get to something, how to get to like more interesting insights in the brief?
Well, don't wait for your planners to give you the brief, like especially your creative directors. Like, we are very hand in hand. You know, the way that our strategy and creative department works is it's like, you know, a strand of DNA where it's like kind of going back and forth all the time. So it's not about like, they're going to go off and give you this document and then they're going to put it in front of you and then they're going to say, what do you think? And then you go off and try to make something out of it. It's like, we sit around and we go, oh, that could be cool. And our briefs come with, you know, ways in or thought starters or, you know, ways to think about this. And another thing we do, which is something unusual for this industry, but it's really helped us, is we don't just give one brief. We brief two or three ways into teams. And we tell the clients, you know, we don't know which one's gonna lead to the most interesting work. We know there's something in each one of these, but let's just see what comes out. And we don't promise that we're going to give work on each of the two or the three. But we do say, like, if we like stuff for both, we'll bring both. But if we just find one is really fertile, we'll just chase that. And I think it frees people up.
Yeah, that's great. I've done that a few times, but we should all do it more. Like have multiple ways in, because you don't necessarily know what's going to bring the most interesting ideas.
It's also like, I think two, maybe three, because a lot of times as a creative, you'll spend your time kind of deciding which one you should be working on. It's like bouncing around too much, but I do think it does help you to kind of have the flexibility to think about it a number of different ways.
Let's get into some questions about creative direction. As a creative director, do you like to put just one team on stuff? Do you generally put two or more teams? Like, do you have any sort of a philosophy on that?
I mean, when we can, I love just putting one team on it because I just think there's something about the ownership of it. Sometimes, you know, it's just like the timing is tight. We put two teams on it, or it's just like a project can go a number of different ways. We want to make sure we can explore all that. We'll put more than one team on it. The other thing that's happened at Mischief is we bring a lot of ideas. We've broken the rule of only bring three. We bring a lot. And so many times clients have bought in more than two ideas. You know, like, we'll make this, we'll make this, we'll make this. I mean, that's what happened in the Super Bowl with Tubi, is we had a bunch of ideas and they liked two of them. So we'll do both of them. Malls. So, yeah.
What's the most embarrassing thing that's happened to you in your job?
I think getting fired in front of the world.
That'll do it.
I will tell you something about that is, like, you know, I got laid off on, like, I think it was like Monday or whatever. Yes, Monday. And I was like still on this thing. I was like, okay, let's just let this slide. You know, people, everybody's crazy. There's so much going on that no one's paying attention to this. And I was like, I figure out a way to tell my parents, you know, my family. And then I get a call from ad age that's like, we're running a story on this tomorrow, so you want to give us a quote? I'm like, no, I don't want to give you a quote. I want you to run a story on this tomorrow. And, you know, before I knew it, it was like front page news. And, you know, whereas like in the past, if someone was to leave their job as a chief creative officer, they would very much slide that. You get 3 weeks to do the to manage the PR and tell the story of, we were just departing our, you know, went our separate ways and he's off doing something else. And I'm excited about my new career and we wish him the best of luck. There's none of that. It was like front page, me and Dave Rolf, you know, become poster child for getting, losing your job. So yeah, that's probably up there.
Why was that, by the way? Like, why was that? Cause you're right. Usually that's handled like very respectfully. And it's like the agency tries to put up a front as if this was just like a mutual decision, or they're moved on to ambiguous other opportunities.
Yeah.
But in your case, that didn't happen. Why do you think that was?
I think because they panicked and they need to show shareholders, literally, you know, and the board, that they were going to make drastic changes to the balance sheet. You know, they're going to do some big moves, and, you know, they're going to try to right size themselves for whatever's happening in the pandemic. So I think it was much for like a show. It was symbolic in a lot of different ways.
Well, good for you for, I think a lot of people could have just really let that sent them spiraling down a dark Dante's Inferno hole. And, you just kind of moved on and looked to the next thing and did something. I imagine you look back now and you're like, I'm so glad that happened.
Yeah. And I say this to anybody out there, cause I know it's super rough and I see people getting laid off and having a hard time getting a job. Don't go down that hole, because what you'll find out is, you know, a lot of people say it's the best thing that ever happened to you. And you'll be like, you really want to punch that person, but they're right. You'll find out, like, fate has a way of, you know, working out it, you know, in the end, if you let it. So I think that, you know, what often seems like you've just closed a door, and sometimes you have, but that's a good thing, because you'll find another one down the road that's even better. And yeah, you would never have gotten there if you weren't forced. Like, I was so happy and comfortable, so I thought, in that role that I could have easily ridden out the rest of my career there. And that wouldn't have been the worst thing for me. I don't think I would have enjoyed as much as anywhere near what I'm doing now. But I just didn't know it because I was just in it.
I think fate will work out amazingly for you if you have the right attitude and outlook.
Yeah.
If you decide to like lean into a narrative of like, I'm a victim and this is horrible and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to me, then things might not go great. But if you,
yeah, again, it's the Danish, you know, sailors thing of like, don't complain about the wind, learn to sail.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a good way to think about things. It doesn't mean you have to accept things, you know, and just like go with it. You still have to steer, but it means that you don't fight fate.
You almost have to have faith that there's something even better mm-hmm. out there in the midst yeah. of, you know, the horrible, it's like a bad breakup. You're like, you gotta just believe there's somebody even better.
Yeah, better it is. Here. Yeah. And I'm sure all of us have in our past, like, thank God I didn't go that way, you know?
Yeah. So as both a CD and a CCO, and you can answer this in either role or both, we all make mistakes. You know, you don't get much training for those roles. Mm-hmm. So you get thrown in the role and you try to figure it out. And I know for me, I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, well, I did not know what I was doing. And I definitely did the wrong things in this particular situation or whatever. What are some of the mistakes that you made as at any stage of being a CCO, but probably tends to happen more, you know, in the first couple of years?
Yeah, it's usually in the first couple of years that the ones you remember. I think anytime I feel like I've made a mistake, it's because I haven't gone with my intuition or what I thought was right. I was second guessing or trying to figure out like what somebody else wanted. And again, it's like, even if you win a pitch that way, you're going to end up kind of in a miserable situation. So, I just think it's always comes back to be true to yourself and try to make the work that you believe in. And, don't make bad choices based off of fear.
Fear is never going to lead you to a good place.
Yeah. I mean, specifically, I can't really recall any other than maybe taking on a pitch we just knew wasn't right for us, or something like that.
Yeah. One of the things I found hardest about being the creative leader of an office is everything you say has 100 times the weight to it. Mm-hmm. And, before you become a leader, and this goes for any leadership position, I'm sure, you can make flippant comments and you can be a goofball all the time and be sarcastic. And one of the things I found the hardest was I kind of had to tamp down my personality, because at the beginning, and this was a mistake, at the beginning, I was just I'm myself. I'm just going to be myself.
Yeah. And
what you find is that you're in a different position and you maybe can't always be your full self, which is a horrible thing to say because it's the opposite of what we tell everybody, be your full self. But people are just, they're hanging on every word you say and they're overthinking it. And they're sometimes jumping to the worst conclusion that you'd never meant.
Yes. Yeah. Your words can send someone into a spiral. I don't think it's you can't be yourself. I just think you gotta be your best self at times. You can't let yourself your vibe will set the tone of the agency. So if you're harsh or negative or always making fun of things and, super cynical and super jaded, people think that's the vibe of the agency and it's okay to be that way. In the reverse is also true. If you're just more open and sort of let things kind of be playful and have fun and always look for the best in things, I think, you'll naturally draw those kind of people and draw those things out of people. And they'll see that's the way we behave around here. I think there was a thing in advertising too, where it's one thing I didn't want to do at Mischief is ever think of the clients as not our best friends. There's a tendency in agencies to not like the clients or make fun of them or talk down upon, dirty little secret, clients are listening to us. But at Mischief, it's like they are the people that are helping us win and they want the same things we do. So it's you kind of get this feeling we're in it together versus us against the client. So I think that's helped us. We all just kind of enjoy each other.
Yeah. There are patrons. They're the ones that fund our creativity and our,
they want, what I learned in Mischief is they want you to succeed. I used to get this feeling going into meetings where it's like, oh shit, they're just going to come out and firing squad. It's like, no, they really want you to bring them good stuff. It makes everybody's life easier. And as a creative director, you kind of learn that too. There was a point where as a junior, I always thought they're here to kill my shit. I just need to survive this room. And then we're okay. But as a creative director, what you learn is please bring me something I'm going to be excited about. You will make my job so much easier. And, so know that everybody's rooting for you to win. Just give them live up to that.
Yeah. As long as you can show the client that your creativity is directly solving their problems and the goals
they
have, they're absolutely rooting for your success. The only time when it feels like they're not, it's because they don't see that your solution is solving their problem, or they don't trust, they don't trust your motives and they don't trust that you have the same goals that they have. But if you can show them that you do have the same goals, that you're a partner to them, you want them to succeed, and that the creative idea is directly doing that, then they're rooting for it.
Yeah. Clients can sniff a mile away if you're just in it for yourselves and don't care about their business problems. So, and that's amateur stuff anyway. It's if you're going in there with that attitude, you might as well still be in school. So I think you got it. The challenge is solving a problem and solving their problems in an interesting, creative way. And I think as long as we're all like, why wouldn't we all be pulling in that same direction if that's the goal?
Cool. Well, I've picked your brain of all the ripe fruit that I could get out of it.
Oh, wait, you've reached the bottom of the barrel for me.
But thanks for being on. And honestly, thank you for, I'll speak for myself and so many other people in the industry that you've been an inspiration to. And, you know, from my earliest days, when we were both young men, you were somebody that I didn't know, but I saw in the award books and I knew your name and I was like, that's the kind of work I want. You know, I want to do great work like people like Greg Hahn are doing. So you've been an inspiration.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you for saying that. That is like miracle growth for my imposter syndrome. So yeah, thanks. appreciate you having me on. I'm excited jump into our lotion business. That's where the future is for me. And I think we got it.
I think we both have a pretty good sense that that's going to replace all of our other income. And
that
the future for us is in middle-aged male lotion.
Skincare. Yes. Skincare. I'm on it.
All right. I'll send you the man. I'll send you the legal paperwork later today. We'll get it going.
I'll have my lawyer look over it. Sounds good.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks, brother. See ya.